did. He persuaded Griffin to let him inject him with a painkiller, then used a potentially lethal amount of diamorphine. But he wants to speak to you first, alone. Jess's legs feel weak. She leans against the wall. What does he want to say to me? She whispers. That's what we'd like to know. It's against protocol, but we think he knows something. Something that might help us find the Echo Man. Jess's head snaps up. He's not involved with that. Really, Jessica? Elliot says. This guy tries to kill my brother in exactly the same way as Britain's most prolific serial killer, and you don't think it's connected? Jess shakes her head over and over again. He's not. He can't be. Not him. Not Nav. DCI Elliot opens the door. Jess can see determination on her face. It reminds her of Griffin. Let's go see, shall we? The detective says. Chapter 66. Jess looks through the small window in the door. She can just see Nav slumped at the table. He's wearing a grey tracksuit, a light blue blanket draped around his shoulders. His hands are handcuffed in front of him. His head is bent. She looks at DCI Elliot, standing next to her. What should I do? Jess asks. Let him lead the conversation. He's asked to see you. There must be something he wants to say. But there's no way I'm letting you in there without listening to your conversation. Your every move will be taped. Every word recorded. Understand? Jess nods. Elliot opens the door and Nav turns, going to stand up when he sees Jess. Sit down, DCI Elliot says sternly. You have 10 minutes. And she closes the door behind them.
Jess, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Nav slumps back into the chair again. He puts his hands over his face and starts to cry, shoulders heaving. Jess reaches over and takes his hand. He looks up at her. He looks awful. His eyes are red and bloodshot, his face drawn. She grips his hands tightly. They're clammy and hot. Nav, Jess says softly. What happened? They're saying you tried to kill Griffin, but that's not right, is it? She has to struggle to keep her emotions in check. She wants to scream at him, shout at him to stop being so stupid, but she has to stay calm. She has to help him. He shakes his head.
I'm so sorry. He told me I had to.
Jess feels an icy shiver run through her body. Who told you, Nav? Nav looks up, and his eyes fix on the black dome in the corner of the room.
They're recording us.
Yes. He leans forward towards her, lowering his voice to an almost imperceptible murmur.
They can't know, Jess, he said.
Who?
I don't know. I had a note left in my locker. It said he'd be back in touch soon. There was a memory stick with it.
He looks down at his hands, crying again.
I plugged it into my computer. It was a video file. It was you, Jess. With a man.
Jess can hardly breathe. The room is stiflingly hot.
What man?
She whispers.
I don't know. I didn't recognise him. It looked like you were in some toilets somewhere. You were...
His voice tails off and he takes a shuddering breath in and out.
You were having sex. The timestamp said it was a week ago.
Jess can't move. Toilets. Some bloke. Someone, somehow, had been filming her the day of the fire. She feels her skin prickling, her face flushing.
When did you get this?
Jess manages to ask.
Today. Then as soon as I finished watching, I got a message. It said that unless I...
He's crying again, sniffing back snot and tears as he talks, his voice no more than a whisper.
Unless I killed Griffin, he would give this to the police. He was very specific. He talked about diamorphine. And then you called and I had the excuse I needed. I couldn't have the police having the video. It shows motive, Jess.
I didn't kill Patrick, Jess mutters, still stunned by what he's saying.
I know, but that wasn't all. There were photos of women.
He screws his eyes tightly shut.
Dead women. Murdered. He said he'd do the same to you. That he'd kill you and Alice. That he'd make you suffer. Torture you. Rape you.
So why didn't you call the police? They would have protected me. He looks at her.
The very people you hate. The people you ran away from in the hospital, leaving your daughter behind just so they wouldn't arrest you. And he said it wouldn't make any difference. He would still get to you.
But to kill someone, Nav! To kill Griffin! Jess cries out. Nav can't look at her, but he squeezes her hand tightly with both of his.
I love you, Jess. I always have. I'd do anything for you.
There's nothing Jess can say. She did know, deep down, how he felt about her. But her shattered self-esteem never allowed her to believe it. Not really. Someone like Nav falling for someone like her. But now, this? This is crazy. Where's the memory stick now? She whispers, glancing back at the door.
Still at work, in my locker. Why?
Then he realizes. You can't possibly go and fetch it. Jess, it's too dangerous. This man...
Promise me, please.
I promise, but Nav, you have to tell the police. Tell them everything. Otherwise they'll charge you with attempted murder. You'll go to jail. The door opens and DCI Elliot comes back inside. Have you said all you need to say, Dr. Sharma? She asks, her voice cold. Nav nods. His face crumples and he starts to cry again. Sobbing now. His head in his hands, fingers raking at his hair. Jess wants to hug him, but DCI Elliot pulls her into the corridor. She hands Jess a tissue, and Jess realizes she's crying too. What did he say?
You tell me, you were listening.
But Jess realizes they must have been speaking too quietly, and Elliot is still in the dark. Stop playing games, Jessica. What did he tell you?
Just what you said, Jess replies. That he injected Griffin with diamorphine.
Nothing else?
And that he loves me.
DCI Elliot raises an eyebrow. That's becoming a bit of a problem around here, she mutters under her breath. Elliot escorts her back to her cell. The door slams shut and Jess stares at it, Nav's words running around in her head. She'd promised him, but she knows there's no way she's going to leave that evidence out there. The proof that Nav was blackmailed to attack Griffin. And a motive for killing her husband. Something she knows D.S. Taylor will twist and mould until she's locked away for good. Jess needs to get to the hospital. To get that memory stick. But how could she possibly do that, locked in here?
Chapter 67. The road turns to a gravel track. He cuts the headlights as he brings the car to a stop and climbs out. His eyes take a moment to adjust to the darkness as he stands in the clearing, his hands on his hips, looking up to the sky. A shard of moonlight cuts through the clouds. He knows it's going to rain soon. He goes back to the car and opens the boot. She looks up at him, her big blue eyes wide with fear. Her hands are tied in front of her, her feet bound, and she breathes hard through her nose, the tape on her mouth moving in and out in a quick rhythm. He grabs her hands and pulls her up. Her naked skin feels cold to his touch, and she's shivering. But that doesn't matter to him now. He carries her to the middle of the clearing, then drops her into the mud. She looks up and sees the rope hanging loosely in the tree above them. Her eyes bulge. She makes a muffled scream and tries to move, but she's tied too tightly, in too much pain. He watches her, amused. He likes her spirit. Maybe once he gets going, she'll hold on longer than he thinks, and he pulls her back, rolling her over to her front and planting a quick kick in her ribs. She moans, then lies still, her chest contracting with the force of her panicked breathing. But this woman is just the starter, his entree, the bit you sample before the main course. He's saving the best for last. Jessica Ambrose. Beautiful, exceptional, unique, his angel. When he'd seen her at the supermarket that day, he'd recognized her from all those years ago. The woman she'd grown into wasn't so different to the kid she'd been at the children's home, and all the pieces had fallen into place. He'd recognized the adoring look in her friend's eyes, the NHS lanyard around his neck, and known there and then how it would work. He knows she's at the police station now, but he's not worried. There's nowhere he can't get access to, no obstacle he can't overcome. The doctor had been useful. Shipman had ruined it for everyone. It was hard to get hold of controlled drugs nowadays. This guy had access to diamorphine. He knew how much and where to inject. And Dr. Sharma was perfect, honest, genuine, in love, everything he hated. He wants to destroy all that's good in this world. He walks to the car and takes out his bag, carrying it back. He kneels next to the woman, then takes out each tool in turn, laying it down so she can see. The knives, a large hunting knife, a long thin fillet knife, a few scalpels, all clean and sharp, a costatome, his new toy, shiny and unused, a specialist bone cutter, bought especially for today. He's looking forward to that in particular. Time to begin. He stands up again, picking up the biggest knife. She's been staring, as he hoped she would, and now she makes a frantic animal cry, her head shaking. No, no, no. But he places his knee on the bottom of her back and leans forward, his left hand on her neck, all his weight forcing her immobile. He's enjoying the moment, feeling the weight of the knife in his hand. Then he reaches down, holding tight to her neck as he pushes the blade into the skin on her back. It goes in easily, and he starts to cut, dissecting muscles, cartilage, arteries, and veins. Her fingers splay outwards, her muscles tense, her feet twitch with pain. She's screaming, as best as she can, her breathing laboured, her face pushed into the mud. But it doesn't stop him. He continues to work, sweating now with exertion, until he notices she's gone still. He stops for a moment. Her eyes are closed, and he puts two fingers to her neck. There's still a pulse, weak and thready, the last residue of life hanging on. He stops what he's doing and moves around to her face. He picks up a small scalpel. It's only right, he thinks. When she wakes up again, she'll want to see this. He doesn't want her to miss a single thing.
Chapter 68. You're having a laugh. D.S. Taylor stands facing Kara, her hands on her hips, face like thunder. No, I'm not having a laugh. Kara spells it out slowly. You have to let her go. She'll just run again. That's what I'm hoping. Dr. Sharma told her more than just declarations of love. She has something in mind. I want to follow her. Taylor makes a loud exclamation and throws her hands in the air, turning away. Kara knows Taylor has no choice but to do what she's asked. She is the superior officer and has the agreement of DCS Marsh, but it doesn't stop a small part of her enjoying pissing her off. Taylor, she shouts down the corridor at the departing detective. Tell me when she's released. She receives an annoyed hand in the air in response. Kara returns to the incident room, where the team are anxiously waiting. Kara stands at the front. Right. We know Jessica Ambrose is a flight risk, so no screw-ups, please. But we need to know where she's going. Like many of you, I don't believe Dr. Sharma is the Echo Man. Wilmington, follow up with the hospital for alibis, please. But I'm under no illusion that he did this under his own volition. She assigns duties to the team, ensuring that every move Jessica Ambrose makes is covered, while other detectives continue to follow up on leads at the station. She's nervous. She needs this to work. Her phone buzzes in her pocket and she pulls it out. Being released from custody now, the message from Taylor says. Called her a taxi. Kara leaves the incident room and goes down the stairs to the main reception where Jess is waiting. She watches her through the glass panel in the door. Seeing Jessica Ambrose up close has been interesting. She's seen photos, sure, but Kara's fascinated now she's there in person. The woman Griffin's been risking his career to hide in his flat. And she looks a mess. She's not wearing any makeup. Her hair is barely brushed, tied up in a loose ponytail. She's wearing badly fitting clothes, including a jumper Kara realises was Mia's. Seeing it makes Kara jolt. Griffin's worship of his wife was all-encompassing, and Kara realises how much Griffin must care about Jess. Dr. Sharma, too. And she wonders why. Jessica Ambrose doesn't seem particularly distinctive. She's pretty, yes, but not astonishingly so. She doesn't smile. She's grumpy rather than charming. But then Jess stands up. Kara's musing will have to wait. The taxi has arrived. They're on the move. Chapter 69. Released under investigation. Jess doesn't know what that means, except she's glad she doesn't have to spend another moment in that cell. She's out and in a taxi, heading for the hospital. She arrives and uses Griffin's card to pay. She's been here a few times with Nav, so she knows where she's going. She's guessed his locker is in the men's changing room, and she heads towards it. She knows Griffin is somewhere in this hospital, and she's desperate to see him. She needs to be with him. She feels a pull that she hasn't felt with someone for some time. With her husband, the overwhelming feeling was disappointment, that her very existence was letting him down. But Griffin takes her as she is. There's no attempt to fix her. But she can't see him now. Finding this memory stick and the photos are more important. This is the only evidence that Nav was blackmailed. She'll give it to the police, and they'll know. She reaches the men's changing room and, glancing around, pushes the door open tentatively. To her relief, the room is empty, and she heads to Nav's locker. She knows him well and enters his old room number into the combination on the padlock, clicking it open. Inside, she finds his laptop bag, and she pulls it out, lying it down on one of the benches and scrabbling in the pockets. There are two memory sticks inside. One with the initials NS scrawled on in pen. The other black and bare. And then the photographs. A bundle of five in a plain white envelope. Old-fashioned white frames around the plastic. The images blurred and hazy. But Jess is in no doubt what they are. Women. Eyes wide, mouths screaming. Legs apart. Bloody fingers in front of their faces, trying redundantly to protect themselves. Her hand goes to her mouth. It's no wonder Nav felt he had no choice but to inject Griffin. With the knowledge of who this man had already killed, seeing this as evidence of what he could do. To her. She feels cold horror trickling down her back, knowing the risk of being here. But Jess has to see it for herself first. She could have just told DCI Elliot as soon as she left the interview room, but she feels the complete humiliation of being filmed with this guy. She wants to watch it, to see what Nav was seeing, to confirm for herself what a shitty person she is. She gathers it all up and leaves the changing room, hurrying down the corridor, looking for an empty space, anywhere where she won't be disturbed. At last, she sees a cleaner's cupboard and opens the door, turning the light on. She closes it behind her. Sitting on the floor among the mops and buckets, resting the laptop on her knees. She turns it on, logs in as a guest user, and impatiently waits for it to boot up. The home screen eventually loads and she puts the black memory stick in. The computer hums. Then the symbol for the drive appears on the desktop. She clicks on it, nerves making her hands shake. There's one file. The video is grainy and black and white, but Jess can clearly make out the toilet she remembers from a week ago. The camera position is up high. It shows the sink and the door. There's no one in the room. The door opens and Jess watches as she comes into the bathroom. The man follows in behind her and starts kissing the back of her neck, and she turns and they start kissing properly. Jess feels her face go red, her back sweaty. How could she have done such a thing? At the time, she knew it was wrong, She knew it was reckless, but it felt in keeping with her damaged mind, her broken shell of a body. But now, watching it here, it looks awful. This random guy fucking her is horrible. She's ugly, a terrible excuse for a person. She feels as though she's suffocating. She starts crying, knowing that less than 24 hours after this, her husband was killed. She turns away from the video. She can't watch it anymore. But just before she does, something catches her eye. It jars, even more so than the rotten act itself. She wipes her eyes on her sleeve and looks back. On the video, she's facing away, bent over the sink, her skirt around her waist, the man still behind her. So what was it? She pauses the video, then winds it back a fraction. She presses play again. Then she sees it. She stops. In those few seconds, she's paralysed, her breath halted in her lungs. The man's still there, still fucking her. But for one split second, he looks up. He looks up right into the camera. And his expression? Pure hatred. Chapter 70. When Griffin wakes, his whole back is in pain. For a moment, he's confused. He hears the beeps of the monitors, the sound of voices in the corridor, sees the blue curtain pulled around his bed. Memories from just over a year ago force their way into his head. Waking up in hospital, head pounding, barely able to open his swollen eyes, plaster casts encasing his arms. Not able to move, as he was told Mia was dead. He squeezes his eyes shut again. He remembers Jess leaving the flat, then the knock on the door and Nav standing there. Something about the doctor seemed odd from the word go. His shoulders were stooped, his hands shaking as he put his bag on the floor. He wouldn't meet his eyes, but Griffin was in so much pain, his body aching so badly, that he hadn't cared.
"Have you got the pills?"
Griffin had asked, collapsing back down on the bed. Nav had nodded. "But you'll need something else first. Your withdrawal is more established than I expected." Griffin had grunted in agreement. He'd let the doctor roll up his sleeve, put a tourniquet around his arm. He felt the quick cold of the alcohol wipe, then the prick of the needle as it went into his vein. Then the relief. The blessed, all-encompassing rush of euphoria as the opioid hit his bloodstream. He'd felt Nav watching him and opened his eyes, surprised to see the doctor crying, the syringe and needle still in his hand. He'd shaken his head. "I'm sorry," he'd said, backing away from Griffin, then turning and rushing out of the door. Griffin knew something was wrong. He knew what these drugs were like. He'd had enough of them in his system over the past year, but this felt too much. He'd tried to stand up, but his brain was woozy. He'd wobbled to his feet. He knew he needed to find his phone, call someone, but the world was sliding sideways. The floor rushed up to his face. He felt the knock to his head as he hit the ground. Shipman, he thought. How could he have been so blind? To let Sharma into the flat, trust him to pump him full of drugs when there was a serial killer on the loose copying murderers from the past. His face still pressed into the floor, he'd lifted his hand and with a shaking finger ran it in the dust. He'd managed 5 letters before he passed out. He'd first woken with a jolt, still in his flat. Unknown faces staring down at him, medical equipment in their hands. He'd blinked at them, his vision slowly clearing, then again, gone. In the ambulance, awake for longer, he'd asked about Jess.
"Your friend," the paramedic had replied. "Sorry, mate, she was arrested."
He'd sworn loudly and tried to sit. The paramedic had gently persuaded him back down.
"You're not out of the woods yet, mate. You've had a considerable dose of an opioid. No sooner do we pump naloxone into you, it wears off and we're back to square one. Sit tight."
The guy had been right. He hadn't been conscious for long. And now here he is, alive, a cannula in his arm, tubes running up to a clear bag on a stand. Oxygen tube under his nose, monitors beeping next to him. He dimly remembers Kara coming in to see him, reassuring words that he was okay, that she would catch whoever had done this to him. And then he remembers Jess, arrested, probably being interrogated by that pathetic excuse of a detective, Taylor.
Shit!
He shouts. Then he slumps back on the pillow.
Shit,
he mutters again, quieter now. But at least she's safe, he thinks. She's with Kara. She'll be okay. At least she's safe. Chapter 71. Jess is frozen. The video is still playing on the screen, but she can't focus. She can't think. He knew. Somehow that guy knew who she was. He knew what they were going to do. She racks her brain, trying to think what happened that morning. Did she proposition him? He spoke to her first, she remembers that now. He commented on the weather, something harmless. But then what did he do? Did he smile? Casually drop an indecent remark? Why did they go into those toilets together? She closes her eyes, tries to calm her breathing. She made the suggestion, but he mentioned the toilets. It's clear. This whole thing was planned. This is him. She has his face on screen. The guy she fucked. The man that set fire to her house. That killed Patrick. That killed Griffin's wife. And all those people. Her stomach rolls and she leans forward, the sparse contents of her stomach suddenly vomited into a bucket. She waits there for a moment, retching, her body heaving, gasping for breath. She knows what she has to do. She needs to get this to the police. She stands up, closing the lid of the laptop and pulling the memory stick out. She opens the door and hurries down the corridor, but as she does so, she sees a payphone on the corner. She stops a man walking past. He gives her a funny look, but complies to her request, giving her a pound coin, which she puts into the phone. She dials a number, known off by heart, and at last someone answers.
St. Mary's Primary, the sing-song voice says.
Hello, yes, I'm hoping you can help me. My daughter's come home with a Transformer toy. She says it belongs to Hayden. Jess is gabbling, saying the first thing that comes into her head. His father's Evan, or Ethan. Or something. Could I have their full name so I can message them on Facebook? I'm worried it's a precious toy and Hayden will be upset. The voice on the other end is hesitant.
What class did you say?
Oh, Oak class, I think. Jess can hear tapping at the other end of the phone. Then another pause.
I can't help you, I'm afraid.
Jess swallows.
I know, it's a data protection thing, I'm sorry. But if you could just give me the correct first name, then I can look it up.
It's not that, the woman says.
Well, I mean, yes, I'm not supposed to give out that sort of information, but even if I wanted to, I can't.
What do you mean? Jess stutters.
There's nobody in Oak class by the name of Hayden. Nobody in that year, actually.
Jess mutters a thank you and puts the phone down. She knows for sure now. It was all staged. How could she have been so stupid? He targeted her like he had his other victims, and now Griffin is in hospital and Nav's been arrested. A sudden thought pops into Jess's head and she starts to run. He knew who her daughter was. He knew where she went to school. She sprints down the corridor, the laptop bag clutched tightly in her hand. The urgency turns her insides to liquid. She needs to protect Alice. She pushes the doors of the hospital open and they slam against the wall with a bang. She knows she's getting looks, but she doesn't care. She has to get to her daughter, and she frantically looks around. But she can't see the taxi rank. The place is deserted. She runs further away from the hospital, catching a glimpse of a sign pointing her away. The road is dark and quiet. There is no one around. Nothing in sight bar an old car parked up on the double yellows. She pauses, desperately searching in the darkness, and a hand taps her on the shoulder.
"Excuse me,"
a male voice says. She glances for a second. He's wearing a baseball cap, his arm in a sling. The collar of his coat is pulled over the bottom half of his face.
Could you help me carry these to my car?
He points to a pile of books by his feet, then to his car. It's a tan VW Beetle, an old one, and the strangeness of this registers somewhere in her brain. But she's too panicked. I'm sorry, I'm in a hurry, she says, and he pulls on her arm again. She turns. She sees his face. Her mouth drops open. It's too late. She feels something hit her head and her legs give way. Her body drops to the hard concrete. Everything goes black. Chapter 72.
What do you mean you've lost her? How have you lost her? Kara is aware she's shouting at the DC at her side, but she can't help it.
We don't know. We last saw her on the payphone down the south corridor, but then she was just gone.
Kara bellows another profanity, then screams down her radio to anyone who's listening. The calls come back the same. The suspect has disappeared. Kara's running now, heading towards main reception. She pushes the queue out of the way and shows her warrant card to the man behind the desk.
Where's your CCTV? She shouts. Your security office!
He points to a small door on the right-hand side, and Kara races towards it, opening it and addressing the guy behind the row of monitors.
South corridor, she says to him,
and he scrolls through the tape. But he's slow, painfully slow, and Kara twitches, impatient.
There, there!
Kara points at the screen and they follow the figure of Jess as she runs out of the hospital. The security guard switches cameras, but they've lost her again.
Where the bloody hell is she going?
Kara mutters.
Taxi rank. Look for the taxi rank, she says.
And sure enough, they spot Jess come into view, on the edge of the screen. She's fidgeting from foot to foot, staring at the empty space where the cars should be. She turns, talking to someone out of shot.
Can you see who that is? She asks,
but the guard shakes his head.
No cameras on that side, I'm afraid.
Jess speaks to the person again, but then Kara sees her fall. Now only her feet are in shot, and Kara watches as they're dragged away.
Shit! Shit! Suspect has been attacked! She shouts down her radio. Repeat! Suspect is down!
She looks at the security guard. He's scrolling through other screens, but they can't see anything. She's vanished. Kara can't believe this is happening. Jessica Ambrose has gone. Next to her, Kara can hear the DC putting calls out to control. She phones Shenton.
Look for CCTV, ANPR, anything, she says. We need to find her.
Kara knows this is no coincidence. The Echo Man has got her. Dazed, she starts walking away, up the stairs, following her sudden urge to be with someone she loves, with her family. The uniform standing guard nods to her as she comes closer and she pushes the door open. Griffin looks up when he sees her. He doesn't look like her brother, dressed in the emasculating hospital gown, surrounded by tubes and equipment, his face grey, without the omnipresent cigarette in his hand. He smiles at first, then frowns with concern when he sees the look on her face.
What's happened?
He says, sitting up.
It's Jess.
Kara can barely bring herself to say it.
We followed her here, but she's gone.
He's taken her,
Griffin says.
I'm so sorry.
He starts pulling at the various wires on his body, wincing as he takes out the needle in his arm.
Nate, stop, she says. You can't leave.
There's no way I'm sitting in here while Jess is out there with a serial killer. I can't.
He pauses, and Kara knows what he was about to say. I can't let this happen again. She knows his failure to prevent Mia's murder nearly drove him out of his mind. She knows there's no way she'll stop him.
What about your back? She asks,
handing him his clothes from the cupboard.
I'm worked up on all sorts of stuff right now. I'll be fine.
She turns away as he pulls his clothes on. He's grimacing, clearly in pain, and she helps him with his boots.
What do we know?
He asks.
Shenton's on point. The team are scouring CCTV. She came here, then disappeared from outside by the taxi rank.
Here?
He asks.
Why here?
She holds out her arm and he grabs it for a second as he stands up. He wobbles slightly.
She didn't come to see you?
No.
Kara can see Griffin starting to lose control. His scowl, the perpetual forward movement. He's acting, not thinking. Nate. Her serious tone makes Griffin stop, and she takes his arm and steers him to the bed. He sits down with a thump. She crouches in front of him on the chair, resting her arms on her knees. She takes his hands. She can feel him shaking. He's scared. Her tough, take-no-shit brother is scared. And that terrifies her more than anything. "I need you to talk this through with me," she says, her voice deliberately measured. Her brain feels scrambled, there's too much to think about, all careering around, bouncing off the sides of her skull. "Help me, please?" He nods slowly. He stares at the floor for a moment, pulling himself together, then looks at her.
"Tell me what we have," he says at last.
She shakes her head. "Very little. He's left virtually nothing behind. A footwear mark from Converse trainers, a Tinder message sent from the police station, a few bits of rare grass found on moorlands from the Sutcliffe murders, and a cipher we can't solve."
"Anything back from social services?"
"It's a dead end. Too long ago, not enough to go on. They can't find the file of that boy."
"And we know he's fond of serial killers," Griffin adds. "But which one? Which one next?"
"Call Shenton," they both say together. Kara dials his mobile, and Shenton answers immediately. She puts him on speaker. "Toby, it's Elliot. What well-known serial killers are still outstanding? Who hasn't he used yet?" Shenton thinks for a second.
"Well, there's Bundy, Son of Sam, Boston Strangler, Gein."
There's a pause as Shenton mentions his name.
"You know what he did, don't you? He
made a suit out of women's skin. Yes, thank you, Shenton." Kara meets Griffin's eyes for a second, then looks away. "Narrow them down to murders that happen near moorlands or countryside."
"The Moors murders? Brady and Hindley?"
"No, that was children. Needs to be a woman victim."
Robert Picton? He lived on a farm. Fed dead bodies to the pigs. Ridgeway? No, that was a river."
Shenton's thinking out loud. Kara can see the annoyance on Griffin's face.
"Hanson?"
"What about Hanson?"
"He hunted down women in the wilderness with a gun and a knife."
"Where?"
"Alaska."
"Fuck," Griffin swears next to her, and Kara moves the phone away from him. "Shenton," she says, "have the results come back on the ESDA test from the note?"
"Wait, just this morning. They found some writing. Could be another code?"
"What does it say?"
"Just a few numbers. 9 to 4, 10 to 12. I can just make out a word. Sat."
Kara frowns. "Send it across to me. Anything from the CCTV?
"No, sorry. But the lab came back on the notebooks."
Kara and Griffin both sit forward.
"And?" "Fingerprints and some DNA, but no match."
"Run it against all police profiles first," Kara barks.
"We did. Nothing. We're onto the national database now."
Kara can't believe it. She feels the disappointment cut through her. She was sure it was someone on the inside. "Call me as soon as something pops," she adds, about to hang up when Toby interrupts her.
"But, boss, I had a thought."
Outside Griffin's room, two nurses start talking loudly. Kara turns the volume up on the speaker, annoyance bubbling. "Go on."
"He'll know you're close behind," Shenton says. "He'll know you're looking, so he would have taken her somewhere where he feels safe."
"What do you mean?"
"He'll go somewhere familiar. His home, a workspace. Somewhere where he can control the surroundings."
Kara feels the dread rising again.
"But how do we know where when we haven't a clue who he is?" she shouts, her voice shrill.
She looks at Griffin. She sees her helplessness, her fear reflected in his eyes. "The Echo Man has taken Jess to God knows where, to do God knows what. It's all her fault, and she has no idea what to do."
Chapter 73. He is close. He can feel it. He looks across to her, slumped in the front seat as they rattle on in his shitty VW. A line of blood runs down her forehead where he hit her, but apart from that, she is untouched. She won't be like that for long. He's glad the end is in sight. He's tired, so weary of all this shit. He feels as though he's two people, the one with Kara, the respected professional, and the other, the one that's killed. He is two souls struggling for possession. Bundy knew it. Geen, Dharma, Brady, all of them had wrestled with the evil half while going about their daily lives, catching a bus, doing their jobs, loving their families. Even love? Yes, even that. It was something he'd never imagined, yet here he was. He prepares himself for what he has to do. Mentally, he pulls on the disguise. He becomes another person. He is only really himself when he is with her, and the thought claws at his insides, knowing that won't ever happen again. But he can't think about her now. This isn't how he thought his life would be, but it's no more than he deserves, no more than he expected growing up in that place. He was alone at the beginning. He'll be alone at the end. And soon. Soon, it will be over.
Chapter 74. They leave the hospital, Griffin following Kara to the car. They need to go somewhere, anywhere. Even back to the station will do, just to feel as if they're taking some decisive action. He doesn't feel great. His head is woozy, his legs weak. He's in pain. But this is more important. He needs to keep going. He has to find Jess. He's tense, his body on the edge of explosion. They have no idea where this madman has taken her or what he's going to do. Kara blips the car unlocked and pulls the passenger side door open for him. He's annoyed at this little gesture. It makes him feel pathetic. But he slumps into the seat, sitting on something in the process. He reaches under his bum and pulls out a phone. The screen flashes into life, showing a red alert. "Andrew, you have a new connection," it screams, demanding attention. He recognizes the logo, the small red flame icon with a T. What's Rue doing on Tinder? And why is his phone here? He feels a smart of anger for his sister and shoves the phone in the glove box to hide it. It's cold outside the overheated hospital, and Griffin wraps his arms around himself. He's only wearing a shirt and jeans, the clothes he was brought into the hospital in. He feels grubby, desperate for a cigarette. He sees a coat left in the back of Kara's car and reaches behind to get it, trying to put it on. The flood of emotion hits him like an avalanche. He feels his hands shake, his body jolted with adrenaline. He looks down at the jacket. It doesn't fit him. It's too small, gaudy red and blue. He remembers Mia picking it out, them giving it to Rue one Christmas. And the smell. He puts it up to his nose and the shock of recognition burns through him, making him dizzy. He's back there, on his old bedroom floor, wrists blistering from the cord, muscles strained trying to get away. He's blind, gagged, but he hears her screaming. Thuds and bashes. Noises from Mia, primitive, desperate cries. He thrashes, turns, pulling again at his wrists, impotently raging against his bindings. Mia cries again. Then there's silence. And the quiet is worse. Far worse. Then he senses someone next to him. A body. Sour and hot. Sweat. Coffee. Unwashed skin. Griffin smells that man now, coming from the jacket. Kara opens the driver's door and he reaches over, grabbing the keys out of her hand, then pushing her backwards. He locks the doors and he sees her shocked face through the window as he climbs across to the driver's seat, starting the engine. Griffin knows who it is now. He knows who it is and where they've gone. But Kara can't know. It would destroy her to see what Griffin's going to do. He puts the car into gear and, wheels screaming, guns it away from the hospital. Chapter 75. Kara falls heavily onto the pavement. She screams Griffin's name after the departing car again and again in frustration. He's realised something. Something he didn't want to share with her. She curses him. She can't believe what he's done. She calls into the station, tells control to track a blue Audi A3, repeats her number plate. She knows he'll trigger speed cameras. He won't care. She just wonders if it's going to be too late. She goes to call the incident room again, but sees the email notification received from Shenton. It's an image of the ESDA markings, and something about it catches her eye. Sitting on the pavement, she brings up the image, magnifying the writing. Shenton was right. Its numbers, faint but clear. Something about it tugs on her memory. And then she realises. 9 till 4. 10 till 12. Sat. It's her handwriting. It's swimming times for the local pool, scrawled down in haste on their last holiday, on their last visit to the lodge. The note for the Zodiac killings, for Libby's murder, was written on a notepad taken from their lodge. In the middle of nowhere. On moorland. Where the killer must have taken Jess. Where Griffin is heading to now. But why? But who? Her mind can barely acknowledge what she knows must be true. She makes an urgent call, requesting a patrol car. She has to get down there before someone she loves dies. Chapter 76. The cold is sudden and shocking. Jess gasps, water running down her face.
Wake up!
A man stands in front of her. He has a bucket in his hand and he places it on the floor next to him. She recognises him immediately. She tries to move, but she's bound to a chair, her feet and hands fastened tightly with plastic cable ties. Her arms are outstretched and she tugs at them, but the heavy wooden chair holds fast. She struggles and it rocks slightly.
Careful. I don't want you to tip over backwards, he says.
He reaches over and gently moves a strand of wet hair out of her face. How are you, Jessica?
Let me go,
she snarls. She's wet through and the room is cold. Her eyes dart around. It's a wooden cabin. Nice pictures on the walls. Throws over a comfy sofa.
Where am I? She shouts. Where have you taken me?
Somewhere we won't be disturbed. He pulls up a chair and sits in front of her. She notices he has a small penknife in his hand. She pulls again, the ties digging into her skin. She needs to calm down, she tells herself. Think. Think. But then she catches a glimpse of a body. Someone lying on the floor, their back to her. A man.
Who's that?
She stutters. He glances back, his half-closed eyes hardly taking notice of the prostrate figure.
No one you need to be concerned with. He tried to defend them, you know. Those kids.
What a fucking hero. He adds this last sentence bitterly, resentment creeping into his voice. Breath catches in Jess's throat. He sees her horrified expression.
Don't worry, he says. They're fine. Drugged and asleep in the bedroom. I love Tilly and Joshua. They were never my plan. But I needed to get back for you, so we could talk.
What do you want to talk about? Jess asks. She's trying to distract him. She hopes someone will find her. But how? The little voice in her head says. How? How can anyone possibly know you're here?
You don't recognise me, do you?
He asks.
Of course I do. From last week, from...
He stops her.
No. Not from our encounter in the toilets. From before.
Before? Jess is puzzled. She looks at his face. I don't... But then something about him makes her pause. She does know him. She sees kind eyes from years ago. His smile, nervously handing her the last bit of toast, giving her a toy to play with.
traces of the boy he once was.
The children's home, she whispers.
You were there. He gives her a sad smile.
You do remember me. I must admit, when you didn't recognise me last week, I was upset. Because I remembered you, Jess.
He looks at the penknife, pulling one of the blades out of the handle. Light shines on the silver, dancing on the sharp edge.
But that was over 20 years ago, she stutters.
You were 5, I was 12, he says. You were so scared and unsure. I heard them talking about you. They said they had to take you away from your parents, that your mum was crying as you were driven away.
I don't remember that.
She stares at him. For the first time she realises his manner is strange. He's quiet, reserved, his shoulders hunched. This isn't the demeanour she expected. The man Griffin had described from their police profile was a gleeful, sadistic murderer, ready and eager to kill. This man seems defeated. As beaten as she feels, even though she's the one tied to the chair.
You were only there for a month, he continues quietly. But I knew you were special. You showed me.
What did I do?
Jess whispers.
You held your hand over a flame. I watched your skin turn black and pucker. I watched the blisters form. But you didn't even flinch. You watched it and you smiled.
He holds up his hand to her. On his palm is a scar, the skin tight and red.
You told me to try it. I did it for as long as I could. It was agony. But in the end I couldn't stand the pain. And you laughed at me.
Jess shakes her head. I'm sorry. I didn't understand then. I didn't realise I was damaged.
His eyes widen in surprise.
Damaged? You're not damaged.
He frowns, his forehead furrowing, jaw clenched.
You have something none of us have,
he says, his voice getting louder now.
Something better. I knew that then. Especially when your parents came to collect you.
He laughs suddenly, slightly hysterical.
They came to collect you, Jess. Nobody's parents came to collect them from that place. Nobody's.
No, no, it's just a medical condition. It's nothing.
She sees his face cloud. In a quick movement, he grabs her hand, turning it over, pinning her fingers flat as he reaches forward with the penknife. He jams the blade into the middle of her palm. Jess feels it go through the flesh, hit against bone, sever tendons. It sticks in the wood of the handle of the chair, and she sees warm blood start to flow. She cries out in alarm.
You are special, Jess, he says. Don't ever deny it.
You're crazy!
She cries. She tries to pull her hand away, but the penknife is stuck. Blood drips from the chair, pooling on the floor. She's shaking now, from the cold, the fear, the shock. The man smiles, but it looks forced, no more than a grimace.
Perhaps, he says. Perhaps that's true, because all I ever wanted to be was noticed. I wanted to be somebody.
As he talks, he seems to be gaining strength. The previous weariness has faded. He sits up straighter, pulling his body taut.
I was insignificant. Everyone forgot me. My mother, foster parents, you.
He stands in front of her, looking at her from under lowered brows. She doesn't dare move. To Jess, it looks as if he's wrestling with something. An internal battle between anger and acceptance. Her eyes scan the room again. She can see trees outside the window. It's raining, dark. Then he turns, walking to the table behind him and picking up a large knife. It's huge, with a serrated blade on one side, straight and sharp on the other, and she can't take her eyes from it.
At least you won't suffer, he says, almost to himself.
He crouches in front of her, the knife in his hand, tip pointing towards her body.
You won't experience the agony like the others. I still hear their screams, you know.
He looks up and she sees a flicker of humanity flash in his eyes.
their pleading, their cries. But there was nothing I could do.
Jess stares at him. She won't ask. She won't. But her brain goes there, starting to imagine what he's planning, what he might do to her. She feels her heart racing, panic confusing her thoughts.
And that other girl, what she went through before she died.
He screws his eyes tight shut, shaking his head slowly.
What other girl?
Jess stutters, horrified, but he doesn't reply.
What do you want from me?
She cries. Snot and tears run down her face.
I'll do anything, please. Just let me go.
I can't do that. I'm sorry, Jess. I just can't. You have a part to play in all of this. Otherwise it'll never end. It'll never be over.
And then his head snaps up, as if remembering what he's there to do. He stands, goes back to the table and picks something up. It's a gun, small and black. And he puts the knife down for a moment so he can pull back the slider. It cocks with a metallic snap.
It's time, he says.
She notices his voice has changed. He sounds resolute, certain now. The effect chills her to the bone.
Please just let me go, she whispers.
He stays silent. Pointing the gun at her head, he pulls the penknife out of the arm of the chair, out of her hand, then uses it to cut the cable ties around her ankles. She looks at the hunting knife, still left on the table. She looks at the door on the far side of the room. He follows her gaze as he folds the penknife away, putting it in his pocket.
Try anything, he says, and I'll shoot your kneecaps off. Pain or no pain, you won't be walking anywhere.
She doesn't move.
Understand?
He asks. She knows she needs to seem cooperative. If they're going outside, she'll run then. It's her best chance. It's her only chance. He's waiting for her response and she stares at him, her eyes cold. She nods. He reaches back and picks up the hunting knife, cutting the ties on her wrists. He pulls her to her feet, then stands behind her, gun against her back, the knife at her neck. She feels the hard metal push into her flesh.
Walk,
he says, shoving her with the gun, and she stumbles on wobbly legs, reaching the door in a few steps.
Open it.
She cradles her damaged hand. It's bleeding a lot now, the wound gaping. She fumbles with the bolts, eventually pulling them across. The wind hits her full in the face as they step outside. It's pouring with rain. They take slow steps away from the house, and she looks out into the darkness. She can't hear any signs of civilization. She can't see any lights. She has no idea which direction to go. She can still feel the knife on her neck, the gun on her back, but the pressure is less. It's a risk, but what choice does she have? There's no one here. No one is coming. With a sudden twist, she jerks away from him, pushing his right arm with one hand, snapping her elbow back with the other. She makes contact, but she doesn't look back. She hears a roar of anger from behind her, making her blood run cold. And she runs. Chapter 77. It's pitch black. She can't see more than a foot in front of her, but she runs. Her lungs strain. She runs, as fast as she can. She stumbles on a tree root, catches herself, pushing through branches and undergrowth. Jess doesn't know how far he is behind her. She feels brambles pull at her clothes, something scratch her face. She catches an uneven piece of ground, rolling her ankle, but she pulls herself up again, running, running. Where is this place? There are no roads, no signs of life. She claws through bushes. She's out of breath, frantic. She hears the bang of a gunshot and she mentally checks herself. He must have missed, she thinks. How many bullets does he have? She thinks of the knife. She thinks of his threat. And she runs. But then she hears another bang and something knocks her sideways. She feels the energy sap out of her body, but she pushes herself forwards. She can't let him catch her. She can't. She glances behind her, trying to see him, but then suddenly... there's nothing. Her foot meets thin air and she feels herself falling, tumbling over rocks and through dirt. Her hands scrabble at the ground, trying to stop herself. She hears the crack as her left leg hits the bottom of the slope. She feels the bone break. She comes to a stop. She can taste blood in her mouth, the crunch of mud between her teeth. She tries to move, but her leg isn't working. And she looks at it in the dim glow. White bone, a piece of tibia. Her shin sticks out of bloody flesh, her jeans torn, leg bent at an angle. She grabs at a tree next to her to pull herself to her feet, resting all her weight on her good leg. She tries to limp, but she can feel the grate of bone against bone, flapping flesh moving wetly around the wound. She falls to the ground again with a cry. Jess curses her broken body. She can't feel the pain, but that can only get her so far. With her leg broken, shattered into pieces, there's no way she can outrun him. She lies still. She tries to slow her frantic breathing. He doesn't know where she is, she tells herself. Maybe he won't be able to find her. Maybe the police are already out looking. Maybe. Maybe. She waits 10, 15 minutes. Her eyes dart, desperately searching. She strains her ears to listen. She can't hear anything but the wind and the rain. Maybe he's gone. Maybe. She should move. She can't stay here all night. In the darkness, she can see she's at the edge of a clearing. She imagines a path, a dirt road, anything that could lead her to help. She pulls herself forward on her elbows and her good knee, fingers gripping the mud to edge across. And that's when she sees it. It's unrecognisable at first. Her brain can't comprehend the shapes. It hangs above her, pale and white, in the haze of the moonlight. It turns slowly, dripping, flapping. The creak of the rope, the black hollows, the dark red, the streaks and stains. And then she realises what it is, and she starts to scream. Chapter 78. She can't look away. Everything in her wants to close her eyes, wants to disappear, wants to stop looking at the horrific scene, but she's locked, focused on the body. It's a woman. Jess realises that now. She hangs above her, a thick rope wrapped around her neck, her head bent towards the ground, staring directly at Jess with those unnaturally wide, open eyes. Her tongue is black and swollen in her mouth, her long blonde hair loose and limp around her shoulders, draped almost artistically over her naked breasts. A patchwork of bruises cover her pale body, mottled purple. Her legs are streaked with red and brown. Her toes point downwards. Mud, rain, blood. Something indescribable, dripping to the ground. The woman is moving slightly, rotating slowly on the rope. And when the body turns, Jess knows how she's going to die. All of the skin on the woman's back has been removed, carved away. Parts fluttering loose, most completely gone. Out of the wound, Jess can see flesh. What she assumes to be lungs, intestines, organs, hanging down, still connected. But worse still are the ribs. Open, curving outwards from her body like stark white wings. Jess's whole body is weak, paralysed by the sight. She can't imagine who could do such a thing to another person. They're not human. They can't be. They can't be. She's an angel. She jumps as she hears his voice next to her, then scrabbles backwards in the mud. He walks slowly into the clearing from behind her. He's soaked, mud staining his clothes, his t-shirt sticking to his chest.
I told you not to run. I told you. He says. His voice is monotone, flat and unfeeling.
He points the gun at her legs, then pauses as he sees the bone and blood bubbling from the hole in her jeans.
Please, please,
Jess sobs.
Please, what did you do?
He glances up at the woman for a second, then back to Jess. His eyes are dark, black holes, unresponsive.
She didn't last for long, he says quietly. Passed out from the pain. Couldn't take it when he cut into her back. When he broke her ribs. Pulled her lungs out. Still breathing.
Jess's hands clamp to her mouth. She can't take it all in. What this woman must have gone through. The pain she must have experienced. She feels sick and hot acid rises in her throat.
Cut her eyelids off, he says, pointing backwards. She needed to watch, see what he was doing to her.
Who?
Jess cries at him. She looks around the clearing.
We're the only people here, you sick fuck!
He laughs, sharp and shrill, then he repeatedly thumps the heel of his hand hard into his skull, his head facing towards the ground, eyes screwed shut. She watches him, horrified.
He's everywhere, he cries. A part of me. Always watching, always here. And now he's going to do it to you, too.
He looks at her again and points the hunting knife towards her. Suddenly, she can't breathe. Her eyes flick from the sharp blade to the woman above her.
A fucking choir of angels.
But then he stops. He tilts his head and listens. Then raises the gun up again, shining, wet black in the pouring rain. The muzzle pointed at her face.
Griffin!
He shouts, the bravado back in his voice.
Nate Griffin!
Jess is confused, but turns as she hears movement in the trees to her right. The man shouts again.
Get out here right now, or I'll shoot your little girlfriend in the head!
Then she sees him. He steps out of the undergrowth. He raises his hands slowly above his head.
Leave her alone,
Griffin says. Chapter 79. Griffin had been to the lodge before, in happier times, with Mia. It was their haven, a little bit of peace and quiet. Where nobody can hear you scream, she had joked. Griffin knows who it is. The Echo Man. He'd been at Libby's memorial. He'd been at the police station just days before. He could have sent that Tinder message, made that one mistake. And he was good with knives. He was a chef, for fuck's sake. But the whole drive up to the cabin, he had struggled with the comprehension. The father of his niece and nephew, Kara's husband. How could she not have realised? How could this man have killed all these people? Have killed Mia? Tried to kill him? But the evidence was there. It had to be true. He'd raced through the pouring rain, knowing that as every second passed, Jess was with a killer. He'd parked up, leaving the car a good distance away, not wanting anyone to hear his arrival. He'd carefully looked through the window, but the lodge was empty. A chair stood alone in the middle of the room, with what Griffin assumed to be blood on one of the arms. The door was open, banging in the wind. He turned and looked out into the darkened woods. He knew they were out there. But where? And then he heard her scream. Griffin followed the noise, running through the trees. Rain poured down his face, soaking his clothes, but he hardly noticed, stopping, listening, then running again, tracking through the woodland, adrenaline charging him forward. But then he saw the drop and at the last minute caught himself. Slowly, he climbed around, carefully scrabbling down the muddy walls. Until he saw it. What was that? A woman, hanging, bloody and broken in the darkness. Griffin recoiled with shock, blood pounding in his ears. Is it? Oh, God. His first thought was it was Jess, and his legs nearly gave out from under him, air rushing from his lungs with a low groan. But then he noticed the blonde hair, and his eyes followed the voices down. There was Jess. Lying on her back, her leg bent at a strange angle. But his relief was short-lived. A man stood over her, a knife in one hand, a gun in the other. And it wasn't who he was expecting. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. But the fingerprints, the DNA on the notebook, it can't be him. And then he heard